Protests in Athens, decision time in Europe, and unease on Wall Street.
Yep, it's a Friday.
From APM, American Public Media, I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles.
And I'm David Brancaccio, New York. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Friday, February the 10th.
Coming up, the latest from the streets of Athens.
A conversation with the U.S. Trade Representative.
And you know that 8.3% unemployment rate we got last week? Well, is it really as good as it sounds?
Those stories and more coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune in to Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
We'll start in Greece, where there are a lot of developments this morning, a day after the Greek government submitted a budget-cutting plan that it needed to submit in order to get more bailout money. There are huge strikes over the cuts going on in Athens today. Oh, and by the way, the European finance ministers say they're not yet convinced that the Greeks are really ready to get their budget under control. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is in Athens today, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Hello, Jeremy.
So bring us up to date. It seems like things are developing very quickly in Greece right now.
Yes, I mean, there is some political turmoil and disarray here. Nothing unusual in that in Greece these days, but it does appear to be getting worse. The leader of one of the three parties in the coalition government says he will not support the bailout package when it comes before Parliament on Sunday. Now, does that mean the coalition is falling apart and the measure won't pass? No, we can't say that, but it might be close. It could be a knife-edge vote.
And, Stephen, there are protests going on today. You've been out in the streets. What's happening there in Athens?
Well, yes, there has been a violent protest outside the parliament, about a mile away from where I am now. Two protesters have been injured. There is a growing anger here, which may well spill over into more trouble, a sign of how desperate some people in this society have become.
Stephen, does it look like all the stars are going to align and everything will get passed, get accepted, and we'll move forward without a messy default in Greece?
It's almost impossible to say, Jeremy. I mean, it does really hinge on this vote on Sunday. It could really go either way. We'll talk again on Monday morning.
We certainly will. Marketplace's Stephen Beard in Athens, Greece. Stephen, thanks.
Okay, Jeremy.
Well, as we were just talking there, protesters took to the streets in Greece. They're angry about the more budget cutting on top of 5 years of recession. Among other things, the minimum wage is getting cut by about 22%. One in five government jobs are being eliminated. The protests are part of a two-day strike called by labor unions that started today. I spoke with 23-year-old Artemis, who's a university student in the port city of Volos. She says many of her fellow students are furious with the long stretch of budget cutting.
The thing is that our generation is in the worst place it could be because our universities are collapsing completely. There isn't any money. The most universities, there isn't even heating right now. Professors are getting fired. The system in the university is changing, and now it's going to be run by the government and some businessmen that have nothing to do with the university. And of course, that when we finish our studies, we will not have a job.
So how is all of this news out of Greece playing on Wall Street? For that part of the story, let's bring in Chris Lowe, chief economist with FTN Financial. He's with us, as always, from New York. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning.
Well, what do you make of what Stephen was saying and what's going on in Greece?
Well, not surprisingly, the markets are closely focused on this for two reasons. One, we actually haven't had very much economic data this week, so we're sort of looking for a story to follow.
Right.
But two, you know, this Greek thing has dominated trading for the better part of 2 years. It used to be every month or so we had to worry about it. Now it seems like it's every day or two. And equities are down sharply this morning.
Chris, what do you make of it as an economist, looking at this from a sort of a macro view?
Well, look, as a U.S. economist, we have to look at Greece and how it might affect the United States. And to echo something Stephen said, it's almost impossible to say. And again, that's why the market reacts the way it does. Euphoria when it looks like a deal will be done. Despair when it looks like a deal won't be done. I don't think this will have, either way, even if they cannot work things out, I don't think it will have a huge impact on the U.S. economy. But what we don't know is sort of the black box financial market effects that might come through.
What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean by that we know the banks are relatively well shielded. The Federal Reserve has reassured us. Ben Bernanke has reassured us. And believe it or not, the Fed now has employees sitting on the trading floors at the big U.S. banks, monitoring positions, meeting with risk managers, and so on. If he says they're okay, they're okay. The problem is this huge unregulated financial universe of hedge funds. We don't know if they're exposed. And MF Global is a reminder,
right,
a timely reminder of what can happen.
Chris Lowe, chief economist with FTN Financial. Thanks so much, Chris.
You're welcome.
The $25 billion settlement between states and those banks that botched the foreclosure process is supposed to help homeowners over time. But right away, experts say there will be an ugly downside of the deal that's not getting much attention. As the settlement talks dragged on for more than a year, many banks slowed down the pace of foreclosures. Now that the settlement's done, expect a flood of evictions and heartache. More foreclosures means other home prices could drop in the coming months.
If new foreclosures are an unintended consequence of the settlement, some of its intended consequences should help the market. For instance, the deal also provides $3 billion to help owners who are paying their mortgage on time but owe more than their house is worth. But how do you know if you are underwater like this and whether you qualify for some settlement cash? Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
An estimated 28% of homes are underwater nationwide, and home values continue to fall. Homeowners who used to be only slightly underwater now find themselves in the deep end. And even once home prices start back up, Zillow.com chief economist Stan Humphries says underwater homeowners shouldn't expect a quick turnaround.
So even while some of these markets are going to bottom in 2012, we believe, they aren't going to see robust home price appreciation for another 2 to 4 years.
Some 3 million underwater homeowners will qualify for loan modifications that make refinancing possible. To find out if you're eligible, Pamela Banks with Consumers Union says check with your mortgage servicer.
If for any reason they don't get the response that they need, then they should report that to their state attorney general, because that's what they're going to be policing to make sure consumers get the help they need.
The attorneys general say they'll be contacting eligible homeowners, but Bank says don't wait for the call. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
The economic giant known as China is coming off a bad month. There's word Chinese exports fell 0.5% in January, but even more striking is what happened to China's imports, down more than 15%.
This morning is also word that the U.S. trade deficit with China soared to a record $295 billion in 2011, just less than $300 billion. That will likely be a topic when the man who could become China's new leader comes to Washington next week. Vice President Xi Jinping has business with President Obama and, among others, the U.S. Trade Representative Ron Kirk, who joins us now to talk about the plan for trade. Good morning, Ambassador Kirk.
Well, good morning, David. Thank you for having me.
President Obama talked about a new trade enforcement team to crack down on unfair trade practices by other countries. I think it was in the State of the Union speech. If you could take me a bit inside this team, how would it work?
One of the biggest complaints we heard from businesses even was that they felt we just weren't enforcing our trade rules. And while America had freely opened up our borders and our markets, many of our competitors, they thought, were gaming the system. So we made a commitment to a stronger enforcement program. We've been working to make sure any of our trading partners, they do one simple thing, open their markets the way they committed to as members of the World Trade Organization.
So, Ambassador Kirk, right now, regarding U.S. trade, would you say the number one violator of trade rules is China?
You know, I wouldn't say that, because the reality is one of the reasons the United States supported China's entry into the World Trade Organization is we realized we had an opportunity to create jobs in the United States by being able to help China with its growth needs. But that only works if China opens up its markets the way we've opened up ours to them.
Which part of this is the most concerning to you? The U.S. and China are on each other's nerves in a variety of areas. I was going through the list. I came up with car parts, wind turbines, raw materials. Is there a particular piece of that that you're focused on?
You know, there isn't one, and my job in particular as the chief lawyer for the President and Congress on trade matters is to do everything we can to work with China through either dialogue or, if we have to, by going to the World Trade Organization and prosecuting a case. That this is one of the most important relationships in the world in terms of keeping peace, in terms of economic harmonization and liberalization, but it's going to take constant engagement.
Well, Ambassador Kirk, thank you very much for this.
Thank you.
Today, First Lady Michelle Obama will be in Dallas, Texas, promoting her Let's Move campaign to get the nation's children to eat healthy. Yesterday, she made the pitch in Little Rock, Arkansas, but not to students. She's trying to make over the menu at military bases. From our health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Gregory Warner reports.
Michelle Obama said yesterday she hoped this initiative to bring healthier food to military bases would send a message to Americans. Robert Paulberg lectures on food politics at the Kennedy School of Government.
Government often uses the military to make important social changes. It was the decision to integrate the Army in 1944 that arguably led to the civil rights movement of the 1960s.
Call it a campaign for hearts and stomachs. The program will bring more fruits and vegetables and whole grain foods to mess halls and cafeterias in the next few months. Vending machines are also getting a makeover. The Defense Department hopes the changes will cut health costs. It spends over $1 billion a year on medical care for military personnel with weight-related problems. Robert Paulberg remembers when he was in the Navy, he always had a chocolate bar in his pocket.
You didn't go too far without making sure you had a snack in your pocket, and candy was the easiest one to carry.
An apple just would have broken his stride. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
So obviously we do a lot of stories about CEOs and the corner office here at Marketplace, their business strategies, stock buyback plans, stepping down, getting promoted, but their high school GPA, or when they propose to their girlfriend. It seems that these days we know more and more about corporate brass as public figures, as celebrities. How much do their personal lives determine the success of their company?
Well, in today's Midday Extra, we're going to talk about the line between public company and public image. And here to talk with us about that is Nell Minow, corporate governance expert from GMI Ratings. She's with us from Washington. Good morning.
Good morning.
So do we really know more about CEOs professionally and personally now than ever before? And why is that?
Well, we've always been fascinated by the wealthy and powerful. I mean, everybody knew about Vanderbilt and Carnegie and all those robber barons. But I think it's a little bit more of the rock star thing happening now. And I really date it back to Lee Iacocca. He was the first CEO to have a big blockbuster bestseller. And I think that alerted a lot of other CEOs to kind of get their PR going and get some high visibility for themselves. We also have had some CEOs running for political office. And when you have somebody like Ross Perot or even Mitt Romney, they bring business into the political arena, and that keeps it visible too. But even with the fact that, you know, Time has their Person of the Year cover, and for, you know, 60 years they had political leaders, and all of a sudden in the 90s, 3 out of 10 were people like Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates. Even so, I don't think that if you ask the person on the street, they could name 10 of the Fortune 500 CEOs.
This week, the FBI, you saw this story, right? They released the old file they had on the late Steve Jobs at Apple.
Yes.
He's being considered for a job a couple decades ago in the Bush administration. Apparently, we learned a couple things. We learned that he wasn't all that involved with his first child at first. We learned that his high school GPA was a not-so-hot 2.65. I mean, does this stuff matter?
Well, it's in the biography of him, which is a blockbuster bestseller as well. And I think in Steve Jobs' case, the fascination with him is not just because he was a CEO, but because he was a visionary. He was a transformational CEO of a company that didn't exist in my lifetime and now is one of the biggest and most important and influential in the country.
Well, let me ask you about another big CEO, Lloyd Blankfein over at Goldman Sachs, who this week came out in support of gay marriage on a video endorsement for an advocacy group. Does a CEO's views on subjects like that matter to investors or to the public at all?
I think it matters mostly to other CEOs, and for that reason, I think that was a very canny move on his part. After all, CEOs determine things like domestic partner benefits in their companies, and when you have somebody who is not normally an advocate standing up for something and saying to the business community, we need to get behind this, I think that it's influential within that community.
Now, you're a fan of transparency and disclosure, obviously. Is it all fair game, almost like a person running for president, or do you think there are limits to what we need to know about who runs these influential corporations?
I think that we should know more rather than less. There have been a number of cases just in the last 10 years where there have been unexpected deaths of CEOs because they haven't been clear about what their health situation is. Steve Jobs is a good example there. He really was very, very private about his health situation. That's fine if you're a private citizen, but you really have to relinquish that luxury as the CEO of a public company because as the board and the investors have to make long-term decisions about strategy and about the for the investors whether they want to stay involved, they need to have some expectation of whether you're going to continue to be there.
Nell Minow is a corporate governance expert from GMI Ratings. Nell, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
What was it like in 1849 in one of those gold rush towns in the Old West? Williston, North Dakota has its own version playing out in 3D. The oil rush in the western part of the state continues to draw loads of new oil workers who then find there's no place to stay. So folks have been living in their trucks in the Walmart parking lot in Williston, sometimes 50 at a time, making some shoppers nervous. Walmart allows brief RV overnight stays, but this week put up yellow notices giving the campers 24 hours to get out or get towed. The Bismarck Tribune quotes a Walmart official saying the company wants to be a good neighbor during challenging times, but it's not just appropriate to be living in the parking lot. Most official campgrounds are closed this time of year.
It was exactly 1 week ago that the government gave us some good news. The unemployment rate dropped last month to 8.3%. But some economists say the news isn't as good as it sounds because some workers have simply dropped out of the labor force. Marketplace economics correspondent Chris Farrell joins us now to clear this up. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Jeremy.
So, Chris, is the unemployment rate really dropping or are people just leaving the labor force?
Well, this is always a key question because you're absolutely right. The unemployment rate, which is at 8.3%, that could reflect, you know, people been pounding the pavement. They finally get work or they could finally say, you know what? I'm not even going to bother because no one is hiring. And usually it's a mix. But the recent improvements, you know, over the past several months in 2011 reflected a lot of people getting discouraged. So we got this good number, 8.3%. What economists did is they looked at the employment to population ratio, and that measures, you know, how many people are actually working. And what it did, it confirmed this was a good number.
Well, by the way, what does it mean to leave the labor force? Do you wake up in the morning and go down and file paperwork and say, that's it for me? Don't bother?
Exactly right. You know, it's that image I always have, someone just throwing open their window and just saying, I'm not going to take it anymore. I've had it. So what it is, it's a household survey. It's a survey of 60,000 households by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And there's these 2,200 trained workers and they ask all these questions and are trying to see, you know, who's actually looking for work. You know, you're unemployed, but you're looking for work or maybe you're working part time and you want to be working full time. And then there are people who drop out of labor force. So some of it can be people not working, people being in prison, people being active duty in the military, and then, of course, people going to school.
So what's the real unemployment rate at this point? Is it 8.3%?
Well, I like the number of 8.3%. Then you can drill down, get more accurate data. If you make certain adjustments, the real unemployment rate's 11%. But then you have to make adjustments farther back. The advantage of 8.3% is that it's a consistent time series. It's like the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Is the market up? Is the market down? Is the unemployment rate up or is it down? And the message of the market is, it's down.
Marketplace economics correspondent Chris Farrell. Chris, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Toy maker Hasbro is teaming up with the online gaming company Zynga And interestingly, it's not the old school Hasbro that's trying to climb the ladder into internet games. It's Zynga that wants to slide into the board games. Marketplace's David Gura reports.
To put it in context, more than 200 million Monopoly games have been sold since it was created in the 1930s. Zynga makes the game Farmville. The company says that 200 million people play its games on computers and smartphones every month. Industry analyst Chris Byrne says the company has been missing out on a big market.
People are learning about games, engaging in them, and then they actually want to play them in the real world, sitting across the table from someone.
Hasbro's rival Mattel capitalized on this last year with an Angry Birds board game. That became a bestseller. Now Hasbro CEO Brian Goldner says his company is following suit.
It's really wonderful to bring to life characters from the Zynga games that people really love and have so much fun playing with.
He declined to say how much the deal's worth. Byrne says it could be a natural partnership.
The buying and selling of farm stuff and buying and selling of fields sounds an awful lot like Monopoly Goes Rural to me.
Hasbro hopes it can reclaim some of the board game real estate it's ceded to Mattel. I'm David Gura from Marketplace.
And finally, Valentine's Day is next week, and Pizza Hut is offering a wedding proposal special for $10,010. Comes with a ring, limousine service, a photographer, a videographer, flowers, and fireworks, which leaves about $10 left for pizza and breadsticks. David, you gonna go for it? You gonna go for the $10,010 special?
I can do pizza at home. That's probably better and for a lot less.
Okay. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm David Brancaccio in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.